Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, November 17th, the What's the Matter with Candace edition. I'm Noreen Malone, an editor for New York Magazine, and I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, the editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Noreen.
How are you feeling?
I'm in a state of, zen.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Floating.
Cool. Hannah Rosen is out this week, so we are joined by a very special guest, Claire Malone, who is 538's senior political reporter.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry. And also my baby sister. So,
Hey, Nora.
long time listener, first time caller, right?
Very true.
Okay.
Very true.
Cool.
Can I just ask? I feel really left out not being a Malone. Can I just be like an honorary Malone this week?
Yeah. Absolutely. June Thomas Malone.
June's not going to work. So I think it needs to be something like Rasheen or like Sinead or something.
Sinead's a great name.
Sinead Malone. Kira. Okay. If I ever go on The Lamb. Watch out for like Sinead Malone.
Sinead Malone does sound dangerous. All right. I don't quite know where to start.
What's our topic this week? Has something happened recently?
The topic is Donald Trump. So the last time we talked about politics, we had a wholly different set of assumptions. So now we live in a world in which instead of celebrating our first female president-elect, we have our first president-elect who has been accused of sexual assault by more than a dozen of women, who was caught on tape talking about grabbing women by the pussy, who said women who have abortions deserve to be punished, who said women facing sexual harassment at work should, quote, find another career, who called his opponent a nasty woman in response to a debate answer she was giving about Social Security, who randomly attacked Rosie O'Donnell in another presidential debate, and who once said of women, quote, you have to treat them like shit. And that man got a majority of the white women's votes in America. So we're going to tackle this one thing at a time. For our first topic, we're going to do why Trump? Who voted for him? Why would women vote for him? And was the vote against Hillary a sexist vote? Then for our second topic, we'll be joined by Neera Tanden, who is the president of the Center for American Progress, to discuss what it means for the Democratic Party that Hillary Clinton lost and what it felt like to have her personal and very candid emails exposed during the recent WikiLeaks dump. And then for our third topic, from Michelle to Melania, we try to puzzle through what that switch will be like, starting with the most surface-level version of that, the fashion industry's response to the women of the Trump family. Or is it surface-level? We talk about the role of fashion in politics and try to answer the question of whether Melania will wear the same Jason Wu inauguration dress that Michelle did in 2009. Then in our Slate Plus segment, we'll discuss whether Ivanka Trump is sexist. We could probably run through the whole Trump family over the next 4 years for our Slate Plus segment.
This time next year is, what's the little boy called?
Barron.
This time next year is Barron sexist.
So if you're not yet a Slate Plus member, you can start your free 2-week trial by visiting slate.com/XXPlus and get in on the ground floor of that ongoing series. Okay, our first topic. Donald Trump's victory proves that America hates women. That was the headline on a piece by Michelle Goldberg in Slate the morning after the election, which begins, quote, "Faced with a choice between a highly competent, if uncharismatic, female candidate and the deranged distillation of the angry white male id, America chose the latter." So, is it true? Does Donald Trump election prove that? June, I'm going to start with you, that small little question.
Let's see. Usually this podcast runs about an hour, but for this one, I should say yes. I mean, how much longer do we have to stretch now? I don't see that there's any alternative explanation. You know, there's no alternative theory of the case. Yes, it was a change election, but that choice?
Well, so maybe we should break it down first a little bit by numbers. So, Claire, you are our numbers gal.
I'm your numbers gal.
538, Nate Silver, hashtag data. So 54% of women voted for Hillary,
right?
But not white women.
Correct. We had a huge gender gap in the selection if you're just taking women overall and men overall. Women very much went for Clinton, men very much went for Trump.
Is 54% very much?
When you look at the gender gap means how much of the percentage, when you break it down, how much of the percentage went for men, like how high was the percentage of men who voted for Trump and women. So I think this was the highest gender gap we saw since they started tallying it up in the 70s.
Okay.
So it was big.
Okay.
But then if you break it down, everyone's been talking about this, but it's basically what happened with white women. And so white college educated women are usually a Republican constituency. Mitt Romney won them by, I think, 6 points or something. And Clinton actually did win white college-educated women this time by 51%.
Which was a story people were talking about a lot. We were excited about that.
Correct. People actually thought that she would be doing a lot. She would do a lot better with white women. They thought that this would sort of, you know, Trump's sexist comments, the accusations against him. They were really counting on white college graduates, female college graduates, going more towards Clinton's side. But the big story, I think, is essentially a class issue. Education is sort of becomes a proxy for jobs, class in America, and white non-college educated women voted for Trump 62%. So Clinton got 51% of white college educated women. Trump got 62% of white non-college educated women. And that is I think that's kind of the story, which is women are divided by class. And I think the way they experience America, right? This, you know, where Trump's message, I think, makes a bit more sense and you're perhaps willing to overlook some of the stuff he said. Because I don't think these women like the stuff that Trump was saying.
Right. What percent? Isn't it like 60% of voters? And was it 60% of Donald Trump voters or 60% of all voters thought that he was unfit for office or had a bad temperament? There's a stat like that floating around.
Yeah. I don't know what that is, but I do think just from a lot of the people that I talked to who were women who were going to vote for Trump, who were sort of traditional Republicans. I remember I was in North Carolina the week after the video sort of broke and everyone was kind of like, yeah, it's not a great thing, but we want to win. And that's what we found when we looked at numbers. This is even, you could actually see glimmers of this happening, which is Republican men and Republican women have the same measure of support for Trump, pretty much the same as if it were any other election. So 2012, 2008, everyone was sort of treating it a lot like a regular thing. You want your team to win. And I think that speaks to this just highly partisan nature of American politics right now.
Before we get too further into this, I just want to ask one kind of high-level question, which is, now, I know at 538 you guys actually understand the polls, but there's a definite feeling among those of us who look at them and just think, I wish I could really understand this, that they were wrong this time around. Mm-hmm. And so if the pre-vote polls are inaccurate, can we put such faith in these exit poll data, which is the source of this, you know, 52%, you know, with all these numbers that you've just quoted? Like, should we believe the information that we get from those exit polls, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, what you see the night of election night and all news, you know, we have a partnership with ABC News and they were very clear. You have to mark everything as preliminary exit poll data. Now we're feeling a bit more sure about, if you can go look at these yourselves, you can go to CNN and they actually have a very accessible way that you can look at what we call cross tabs. So
I'm probably not going to look at cross tabs.
No, cross tabs.
Well, maybe some of your listeners will.
Yeah.
But you're right, June. Like, there is definitely people, I think, as far as exit polls with this election, were sort of worried about that the numbers about Latinos might not be quite right because Edison, you know, there's Edison Research Group is the polling company that's in charge of doing all these exit polls, and maybe they weren't getting a wide enough sample of Latino voters. This is something that my boss can speak much more authoritatively about than I can. But to the wider idea of was this election a polling miss? I think it's sort of a complicated question because there are just so many, like for our 538 model, we have so many different polls that we aggregate.
Yeah.
I think one thing that is true is that Trump did, I think, bring in a lot of people who are outside, you know, pollsters call what they call a likely universe of voters. Uh-huh. So people who are on the Secretary of State rolls for having voted in the past couple elections. Part of Trump's victory was that he turned out people who weren't on those lists, who weren't being polled by pollsters. Now, that's not everyone. A lot of traditional Republicans lined up and voted for him.
Obama voters, right?
And Obama voters, absolutely. So it was a change election. It was a shift. Demographic groups shifted in this election. But then again, there were some really good, there are good pollsters and we rate pollsters. Mm-hmm. So there was an Iowa poll by Ann Selzer a week before the election that showed him up in Iowa by 7 points. And if states sort of move together, so the white college-educated ladies in Iowa perhaps would give you an idea of how the white college-educated ladies in Wisconsin or Michigan were thinking.
And what did happen in Iowa in the end?
Yeah, Trump won Iowa.
Okay.
So Claire, you went out and talked to a lot of these women. Mm-hmm. And one thing I remember you coming back and saying to me, just sort of chatting about it, is that a lot of them said to you, you know, in response to comments like grab them by the pussy and nasty woman, all the sort of gross stuff that we went over at the top of the show, they said to you, well, that's just how men talk. You know, you have brothers, you must know, like, that's just how men talk. They don't, you know, it doesn't matter. And you were upset by that that is how a lot of women in America feel that's how men talk.
Yeah. I think part of it was that was the easy party line that was out there, right? Like that became the campaign's line. And people, if you notice in elections and if you're a politics reporter, voters repeat back to you campaign lines. That's what it's like, you know? So I think part of it was party line, but also, you know, it was, I remember in particular one lady who was just like a very religious, you know, person, obviously had been a Republican for years and years, was showing me their portrait of Reagan and just
Saint Reagan, I think is
no, but it's uncomfortable to watch someone sort of have to do moral acrobatics in order to defend another person. And I think there is a degree of, again, partisanship playing into it. You know, I'm a reporter, I'm sort of enemy, you know, the enemy at the on your territory. So I get that. But I do think that there is a normalization of what women expect men talk about behind their backs. Because quite frankly, I mean, it's not like we know, there's maxim, there's things where like people talk kind of crassly. You do perhaps have this sense that, and I know everyone, there are a lot of men.
Yeah.
And I would say, I bet the male
is not all men.
Hashtag not all men. And that's fair enough. But to my sort of thing is, well, what are you doing as a man when you're sort of faced with someone saying those things? Do you just sort of like ignore it? Or are you actually saying like, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what, dude.
that's what guys say.
In beer commercials they do, which is where I get my versions of masculinity.
That's okay. Right.
So this was a historic election. And the last time we had a historic election in 2008, African-Americans turned out in record numbers for Barack Obama. They did not turn out in record numbers for Hillary Clinton. That sort of makes sense. It's, you know, she's not black, although she got a lot of support from African-Americans. But women didn't turn out in record numbers, right, Claire? Or not as much as Democrats were counting on. There wasn't sort of the same,
yeah,
we'll get out there, we'll get our girl into office.
Women were, so white college-educated women, again, were the group that Clinton was going after, right? She thought that her particular Clintonian brand of feminism would appeal to those women. Mm-hmm. And in the end, maybe it's the Comey letter, maybe it's just coming home to the Republicans, but those people that they expected to win by maybe a Romney margin, 6 points, she only ended up winning by a small.
See, this is the thing that I have the biggest trouble understanding. Like, I understand I'm in my bubble. Unlike you, I did not do any reporting. I didn't go out and talk to people outside my zip code even. And I understand women are not all the same. But just, you know, the things that Noreen discussed at the top of the show, you know, reproductive rights, just access to healthcare, family leave, childcare, these are things that affect potentially all women, even women like me who don't have kids. And And also this historic opportunity. And not only that, not only, you know, the thing that the opposition was talking about, voting with your vagina about in, you know, in the primaries, but the alternative, the candidate, the Republican candidate, mm-hmm. was unfit, is not qualified, has no experience. This wasn't just, you know, Hillary Clinton against generic male candidate. And I feel like women were voting very clearly against their own interests in many cases. Claire, what is the matter with Candace?
That bitch.
I'm so into that pun. I think a lot of politics are, it's sort of, I always end up using a dating metaphor. It's a little bit like pheromones, and people sort of are like sniff. They know what they're
sniffing each other.
No, but what I'm trying to say is it's a cultural thing, right? I think if you drill down and showed a lot of Republican women or women who vote Republican and talked about, I think beyond the issue of abortion, which I actually do think remains as divisive a moral issue in America as anything else. But if you talk about things like Planned Parenthood provides just healthcare for poor women.
Yeah.
I think those, once you drill down to that particulate level, women across the board do sort of believe in those reasonable things. But there is politics is all about how you package it and how you sell it. And quite frankly, I don't think Democrats were adept at packaging those things well to women in parts of the country, you know?
Do you think, so this is also an argument that you and I have already had. We're a little bit on different sides of it. I was struck in the first couple of days how many women were taking this completely personally. Mm. The sort of America hates women kind of headline, the idea that we could never have a woman president or that it won't happen in the foreseeable future now that she missed her chance. And it's not that I don't think that sexism went into this vote, that a lot of men didn't vote for her because of sexist reasons, that probably a lot of women did for reasons that they might not recognize as sexist, mm-hmm. but which are. But I just think that I like her a lot, but a lot of people don't, you know, mm-hmm. and she's great when she has a job, but she's not a retail politics sociopathic charmer, you know, she's just not that person. And I sort of had the feeling like, okay, this isn't a referendum on all women. She didn't win because of her gender, but I don't think she lost because of it. And Claire, I know you feel differently. June, I bet you do too.
I don't know. We Noreen and I had a long car ride. So we talked about this a lot over the past couple of days. I don't know. I think a lot of people had, you know, I'd sort of like shock, right? I think a lot of, I think the Trump campaign had shock. So part of it is just trying to explain what happened. And, you know, not to compare his winning to a plane crash, but this is a,
but let me
go
that.
Ahead. But this is an apt thing, which is, I think a lot of women were writing in the first couple of days about with personal responses, mm-hmm. which is very fair. And a lot of them were, people are sexist. You know, a lot of things have to go wrong for a plane to crash. A lot of things had to happen for Trump to win. So some of it was probably sexism. Some of it was outsiderism. He's just an outsider and she's not. But I think so our argument, Nora, was like that, you know, a woman, if she's gonna run again, it's like the Calpurnia thing, right? Caesar's wife must be above reproach. She has to be the most perfect candidate.
She has to be Barack Obama in heels.
She has to be a Barack Obama in heels. And part of me still kind of thinks that because there are these political science studies that say women don't run for lower office until they have perfect credentials, and men are more likely to be like, I'm a pretty good businessman, I should run for office. So part of me thinks that just by dint of like studies, whatever, like the woman,
or even I'm a bad businessman, I should run for office.
Exactly. Yeah. But you know, I think maybe I'm a little bit more coming to your side of things, Noreen, where I think, yeah, maybe if she were just Hillary Clinton just has all the possible baggage in the world attached to her because of the way she came to power, quite frankly. Look, she is a very qualified person, but one thing that we talked a lot about in the 2008 primary that didn't really happen much this time was she did come to power in part because she was the first lady, because of her marriage. So people have complicated thoughts about her.
Which is common around the world,
right?
You know, women who come to power in often less developed democracies.
No, I wouldn't say less developed democracies. In part, it's to do with parliamentary democracies because it's easier to become the leader of a party because that tends to be a kind of, what's that word? Because that tends to be a kind of technocratic, mm-hmm. you know, way of rising. If you, you know, shake the hands and do the committee work, you kind of deserve, you get what you deserve, which might be a leadership position. And then you get to be, if your party wins, you get to be the ultimate leader. But yeah, it's just, I mean, Claire, for all of your explanations and all the other explanations that we've heard, I just still feel dissed, you know, like it's so often the case that when it's the woman's turn, that somehow it's a change election.
Are you more upset that Trump lost or that Trump, wishful thinking there. Are you more upset that Hillary lost or that Trump won?
I'm upset that Hillary lost because apart from the woman thing, although
you love Hillary.
I love Hillary. And I think that all of her public service has essentially been crapped on. And the idea that you can, that anybody, even not just a horrible person, a sexual predator like Trump, can just drop in and run for the highest office. It's so fucking rude. Mm-hmm. Like, you gotta, like, serve your time, mate. You know, at least run for dog catcher. At least, you know, have a small office.
Yeah, he's the first person who's ever been elected president who has not served in either the military or in an off, in
he
a
got
political
a lot of
office.
Deferments.
I mean,
it's heels. Are we going to be okay with those heels?
But it is. I mean, you know, I think people, however you feel about this, he is pretty unqualified, and I think you're seeing. I mean, I was on the train over here reading all the stories about the transition team firing people. Right. I think the Times used the word purge,
which never is a good word. Let's not use the word purge in the Donald Trump president. But he also, by the way, he tweeted that his transition is going great. His cabinet. No one knows what's going on in his cabinet except for him. But so just to bring it back to the woman question, double X Gabfest. So my colleague Molly Fisher is working on a piece that I think will maybe be up by the time this goes out, on sort of whether feminists, coastal elite feminists, which some people might consider us representatives of, are in any way to blame for this, whether not necessarily to blame, but whether we should have thought a little bit harder about the way that we were presenting support, or that a lot of people were presenting support for Hillary. You know, the t-shirts that said, you know, the pussy strikes back, or the future is female, and people were wearing those to go canvass in Pennsylvania, and it might, you know, be awesome on your Instagram feed, and people in your social group might sort of pat you on the back for it. But is that the best way to win over Candace?
Yeah, Candace, what's the matter, girl? I mean, I totally understand that one has to question everything, but the problem is, I don't know, there's so much that doesn't make sense. There's so much irrational behavior in this election.
But if people are feeling, it seems like a theme that has emerged is that a lot of sort of white working class voters feel alienated by the rapidness of change, by the sort of, frankly, policing of the PC era. And this kind of thing is maybe what contributes to that alienation.
I hear that, but I just think that performing empathy is not really going to serve any purpose.
What about having empathy?
Yeah, having empathy is great, but those women did not feel that way.
Yeah.
And, you know, so this whole thing with, like, you know, the response to peace, to PC, you know, speech policing and all that stuff. You know, I in some of the stories in the postmortems of the election, there's talk of Trump voters being just offended by how much, you know, the Democrats are thrusting transsexuals and bathrooms in their faces. And you know what? That comes from the Republicans.
Yeah, I know. That
it's
drives
the Republicans
me nuts. That
who thrust that into the politics.
Right.
And yes, people with some integrity have to fight back, but it makes me so crazy that it's complete manipulation by the GOP. So yes, the GOP are far better, I think, at crafting messages that people actually respond to. So yeah, it's something has to change, but I don't think that just kind of causing Democrats to be more, essentially be more PC, to behave in a way that they don't actually feel, which I think is what right-wing people mean when they talk about PC. I think they think that the left are performing certain actions.
But how can we, if we want Candace and her friends to vote for poor Candace, we're picking on her, but how you know, if we want someone like that to realize that actually it's in her interest to vote with that woman who is wearing the Pussy Strikes Back t-shirt, how do you do that?
You talk about the economy. I mean, I don't think, by the way, I got to read an Onion headline, which I think speaks to this. DNC aiming to reconnect with working class Americans with new Hamilton-inspired Lena Dunham web series.
Right.
I don't think you stop. I think the Democrats have a belief in moral issues and civil rights issues. I think there are a couple things that have to happen. I do think they have to lead with an economic message. There's no way around it. This wasn't a social issues election.
Right.
This was an economic and a national security election. People are scared. And whether or not you think people are right to feel scared about ISIS in America or, you know, the economy crashing down, that's how people feel. So I think they have to lead with an economic message.
And downplay identity politics and gender?
No, I think people in general, probably listeners of the XX Gab Fest, all, you know, everyone in Brooklyn.
We have listeners outside of Brooklyn,
I know. Brooklyn is a stand-in. But I think that people have to be, I mean, maybe Democrats have to be a little bit of the turn-your-cheek party and be more understanding about people's in the last 10 years, we've introduced a lot of new language and we've made language really important. And sometimes people aren't going to use the right words. And sometimes in order for social change to happen, you have to talk people through it and you have to fight. I mean, I think I have a temper sometimes, right? So sometimes you have to learn how to tamp down maybe your gut reaction to be like, why don't you see this that way? And how does a party as a whole do that? I don't know. I think it means getting maybe more attractive younger people who maybe from, you know, red states, who know how to sort of, you know, in bite-sized chunks talk about those things in a local way. Like, I don't know.
Well, yeah,
I'm sorry. But like, Claire, I think you're right. But again, like, if it was a national security election and if people are worried about ISIS, they didn't choose the woman who knows all about international affairs and has worked in coalitions and has fought ISIS and was there in the room when, you know, the SEAL team caught Osama bin Laden. They chose a guy who knows nothing. It, like, that's the thing that bugs me. Like, I get what people are questing for, but they chose him.
Yeah, I'm not excited about the listening comprehension of America right now. But to help us with our question about where the Democratic Party should go from here, we have a guest. So let's go on to our next topic.
Right on.
But first, June, I think we have a word from our sponsors. Neera Tanden is the president of the Center for American Progress and was the policy director for Hillary Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign. She was also a major part of the WikiLeaks dump of John Podesta's emails. And aside from his recipe for risotto, she was my personal favorite part. As Jonathan Chait put it in New York Magazine, WikiLeaks proves Neera Tanden is a truth-telling hero for saying things like, whoever let Hillary use a private email server should be drawn and quartered. He went on to say that a Clinton presidency would be that much the better for having Tanden in the room. Neera, hi. I wish we were having you on to talk about a Clinton presidency, but instead it's the opposite.
You and me both.
How has your last week been?
I've had better days. The only thing that has made it easier to like get up in the morning is the recognition that the organization that I lead and that I'm part of, the Center for American Progress and Center for American Progress Action Fund, will be an important voice in opposition to what President Trump wants to do. You know, which is deeply disconcerting to even say those words for me a week later, but still.
So, Neera, what assumptions are you guys over at CAP reexamining this week? I know we just talked about this a little bit. We'd all sort of thought that more women would turn out to vote for Hillary Clinton. And obviously that's been a big assumption that we've all been reexamining.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the numbers, you know, that was obviously a grave challenge, not having women break more for Hillary, not having white women break more for Hillary. I mean, I should say women of color in many ways outperformed where they'd been in previous cycles, or at least stayed the same.
Was that something that was an internal worry, or was it something that was being counted on more than actually ended up happening?
I mean, I think throughout this race, there were moments when the race actually got even throughout the last year or the last 6 months where, it was often white women who were kind of floating away from Hillary, and were not necessarily voting for Trump, but floating away. So I think, there was a recognition at different moments that there was a softness amongst that support. But the fact that they, in the last week, seemed to break for Trump, I think was definitely surprising. I mean, the truth is that my sense from both the Trump campaign and the Clinton campaign is that it was relatively surprising. I mean, I talked to a lot of reporters. I was in green rooms with Trump supporters. You know, I worked on the transition. The Trump transition did not expect that, like, was not expecting that he would be victorious at various elements of the transition process, pre-election transition process. So, so it was definitely surprising. And I think there are a lot of contributions to that. We also have to recognize that President Obama lost whites and lost working class whites in particular, but just not at the same levels that Hillary did. And sorry.
Yeah, can I, Nira, this is Claire. I've heard you talk a bit about, you know, the Democrats, I think, are worried about losing white working class voters. And I've heard you make the point, which is very true, that working class is also people of color. But I'm wondering, because there was such a loss of what was formerly a traditional Democratic constituency, these white working class people in the upper Midwest, what do you think, you know, in the soul searching that the Democratic Party is going to do over the next, you know, 2-4 years, is it doing different messaging to these white working class voters, these white women? Is it getting different candidates? I'm wondering what sort of what these conversations are looking like in Washington. What are the steps that people are taking?
You know, I think we have to understand, you know, we have to have a better understanding of what was happening. And I think that that despite President Obama's approval ratings, this was obviously a change election. But I think people want to, it's very easy in politics, mostly because of polling, to say, you know, it was the economy, or it was terrorism, or it was, you know, immigration, or something like that. What I, you know, my sense of it, and we're doing a kind of analysis of the election and really looking at what issues move. My sense of it was that, you know, there are a lot of Americans who are frustrated by both an economy and a government that doesn't work well for them. I mean, if you really look at Trump's message in the last week, I mean, he was attacking on the economy, but his strongest message and his ads were based on, you know, draining the swamp. There's an elite out there, a globalist elite, that is not working for you. It's working for themselves. They have a system that works for themselves at your expense. And so, my sense is that that the interest in change overwhelmed issues like what kind of risk people were taking with this presidency. And truthfully, you know, and I say this with a sad, you know, with a hard, you know, heavy heart, but, you know, it overwhelmed their anxieties that, you know, he was, when people believed he was intolerant, if not racist. So it kind of overwhelmed that sense. And so I do think, you know, my view is that the Democratic Party and progressives cannot waver in their support of and defense in these, you know, alarming times, and their defense of communities that feel under assault. Like, we cannot waver for 1 minute.
Before the results started to come in, right up until, you know, until the 10 o'clock hour on the major cable channels, it was absolutely accepted by everyone, including people in the Republican Party, including longtime Republican supporters, that the demographics of America were making it that as long as the Republican Party was seen as being attacking immigrants, that there was animosity toward Latinos especially, that there was no chance that the Republican Party could win a presidential election, that essentially they were going to be shut out forever. And yes, we saw that a majority of white women apparently cared more about their race than about the fact that a very highly qualified woman was the candidate. But what do you how do you feel right now about that demographic argument?
I think it is a mistake to turn away from the, you know, what many people call the rising coalition of, you know, people of color, millennials, and But we do need to recognize that progressives have had a longstanding support for a better economy and a fairer economy. You know, the way we talk about this, and we've done this work in the past at CAP, is, and this is a shorthand, but you know, there is a strong reason for what we call a Bobby Kennedy coalition, which is to unite, you know, people of color with more working class white voters. And, you know, again, if you look at what happened in 2012 versus 2016, Hillary was able to attract some more college educated whites, but it just got overwhelmed by a deep loss amongst working class whites. And I think the reality of that is that for the campaigns we have to run and the campaigns we have to run in the future, we have to do a better job. Again, many people decided to, you know, kind of cast their vote as a, if I can say this, like kind of a middle finger to Washington and wanting, you know, like not being happy with the status quo. And I think some of those people regret it. As you can see today, there's, you know, only 29% of Americans think that Donald Trump has a mandate for his agenda. I mean, that is lower than George W. Bush when he was selected by the Supreme Court.
So Neera, if a lot of this was actually sexism, right? So how do we actually get a woman elected? Like, down to brass tacks, if America sort of hates women a little bit, how do you get one in the Oval Office?
And maybe who's the next woman?
And who's the next woman? Yeah.
Well, there are a lot of great women. I don't want to say that we won't have a woman. I think what happened in this race was that there was a, you know, my kind of honest assessment is that there were character attacks on Hillary, on her honesty and her trustworthiness that were inflamed because she was a woman. And they kind of used misogynistic tropes and exploited them because I think, like, appeal to a lot of people and their anxieties about women's power and ambition.
Well, a lot of what bugged people is actually stuff you flagged in your emails. You know, people were bugged by the email servers, which it seems pretty specific to Hillary, maybe not, you know, you can't quite universalize that in the same way.
But this is like kind of a perfect example of what I mean, right? Hillary misused her email. Like, she should have had, you know, sure, let's argue, she should have had a separate email. But the fact that she was using, you know, that she misused an email server was considered, I mean, at the end of the day, voters looked at this and said, you know, he has the Trump Foundation and he's hasn't paid his taxes and he's may well have assaulted women and at the very least bragged about assaulting women, but that was sort of made equivalent to an email server. And I have to say, I think my sense of that, you know, and we can all analyze and there were a million mistakes made by a million people, but the fact that the media and, you know, and media that Democrats, progressives trust were basically equating email server use and the kind of grand scheme with all of, you know, like the multiple levels of deep concern Donald Trump raised is an issue. Like, why did we do that? Would we have done that for a male candidate? I don't know. I mean, maybe we would have, but I think a lot of it became, you know, I've said this before, there's kind of a Lady Macbeth thing about women in power. And, you know, people attributed the worst motives to everything Hillary ever did. All the coverage of Hillary was like there were some deep kind of insane motive that she had that none of us understood. She's deeply secretive, all these things. And, you know, I hope that we'll have a good test of this in the future, which is we'll have another woman run and see if it's, you know, it was unique to Hillary or that is what happens when, you know, women run.
Neera, do you still email?
Do I still email?
Yeah.
I do email, but I certainly don't say anything interesting on my emails.
What was that whole experience like for you, having, you know, your sort of most blunt criticisms of your candidate out there?
I mean, it was terrible. I mean, Hillary knows that I give sharp advice and frank advice. I mean, she knows that. But it's just, you know, it was my personal Gmail to a friend and mentor's personal Gmail. And, you know, there were moments of frustration in the campaign when it wasn't clear what was, you know, why things were happening they were. And I, you know, I expressed frustration like, you know, you would to a friend. And I did it on a Gmail account, to a Gmail account, and did not expect the Russians to hack John Podesta's email and put it out there. But I also was deeply disturbed that, you know, reporters were basically covering this as news. And I have to say, if Russians had hacked into the Republican Party's emails and put it out day by day, you know, the entire Republican apparatus would have accused the media of being disloyal to America by using the emails. And I believe many reporters would have been cowed by that. But that did not happen.
Have you ever had John Podesta's risotto?
I have.
Is it good?
I have. It is excellent. You know, John is an excellent cook.
Great. Great. That's all I wanted to know. All right, Neera, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. And, you know, in a month or so when I'm out of my PTSD, I'll hopefully be clear-eyed.
Yes, I think everyone will. Okay, great. Thank you, Neera.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
Okay, on to the questions that really matter. Is fashion's love affair with Washington over? That's the question that Vanessa Friedman tried to answer in the New York Times this weekend in a dive into the Trump's relationship or non-relationship with the fashion industry, which stands in sharp contrast to not only Michelle Obama's embrace of it, but also to Hillary Clinton's. Hillary was dressed by Ralph Lauren on some of her biggest campaign nights and has for decades now been taken over under the wing of Anna Wintour, who, along with a lot of other fashion people, was very active in raising money for Clinton. Meanwhile, Melania Trump buys off the rack, in part because no fashion brand appears to want to be associated with her. So, June, is it important for our First Lady to be a fashion icon?
No.
Next topic.
Yeah, exactly. However, it sure is nice for America and for us and everybody. I mean, like, it's been awesome that Michelle Obama looks so great in fashion that she's really embraced the fashion world, that she went with some not very well-known designers at the beginning.
American designers. Of all races.
Yeah, immigrants. Yeah. I mean, fantastic. She really like had a story with her clothes and she looked great. But I also remember my grandma being like kind of catty, who was like a lifelong socialist and not anywhere caught up in appearances at all. Used to make comments about Barbara Bush, like, why didn't she dye her hair? Or like, why didn't she try harder? And that like breaks my heart. Like the candidate's consort is such a weird role. I mean, you can tell when you look at pictures of Melania Trump right now, she is not psyched for this experience that she has got ahead of her. And so I kind of hate that they're in the spotlight so much and people are going to be paying such close attention to, you know, oh my God, she's got a little bit of a bag under her left eye and all that kind of thing. But when it comes to fashion, like, yeah, it's been great, but like it's always greater in terms of like what the fashion magazines and so on can embrace when it's a younger first lady. So I think actually Melania Trump, former fashion model, is actually, I get that the fashion world is not really psyched about associating with her because they're mostly Democrats. A lot of them are gay. A lot of them are women. Like they're not a natural Trump constituency, but
yeah, a woman I work with who is a fashion writer said that she thinks it'll sort of be like, I forget which designer was the first to dress Kim Kardashian, but she was sort of spurned by high fashion as this sort of like evil, trashy, down market thing. And then some very cool, I think, European designer thought it would be like awesome to like transgress in that way. And that someone will probably, you know, think it's like dictator chic, like, let's do it. Like, you know, the kind of Zoolander-esque version of fashion. But are we being too hard on fashion, Claire? Does Anna Wintour have real power to make change in the world?
Well, she certainly raises a lot of money.
Yeah, for she does.
Fashion's an incredibly powerful medium. I mean,
second biggest industry in New York City, by the way.
Which is crazy. It does have the power to, I mean, I remember reading so many fashion magazines when I was a teenager and it really sinking in. And I think when I was reading them, we hadn't quite reached that sort of like fuzzier, like all bodies are okay thing. And so I think in some ways, you know, Michelle Obama's being athletic and stylish was sort of an interesting message to have. But it's also, I mean, we do place an unfair onus on first ladies to sort of look the part. Like Jackie Kennedy said she didn't like the name First Lady because it sounded like a racehorse. And in some ways, we treat him like a, we do kind of treat him like a racehorse. But she recognized the power of, I mean, she created this, she created her look with Oleg Cassini, and it wasn't just a parochial American like Mamie Eisenhower frump. She was, you know, it was the emerging global power of America was sort of embodied by Jackie Kennedy because she wore European designers and was like this. I mean, so it does have it. I mean, it does have, as much as we might hate it, there's power in clothing. I mean, Hillary Clinton wore suffragette white to all of her big events.
Yeah, Hillary Clinton cares about clothing.
Yeah.
I mean, I also think that there is something kind of empowering about what Michelle Obama has done. Like, a lot of American women really look to her. Mm-hmm. And yes, it was sort of in figuring out how to belt their cardigans or whatever it was.
I'm glad we're over that phase.
Mom still really wants me to, like, work a Michelle Obama. But anyway, I think it sort of is a way for the First Lady to signal the values of the administration, as you were sort of saying, Claire. And I also think it's a way for fashion to signal values. I mean, so this article that ran in the Times this weekend had some pretty wonderfully catty moments where the publicist for Alexander McQueen and Ralph Lauren would only confirm on background that that Melania Trump and Ivanka Trump had worn their brands, and they wanted to make sure that it was known that they had not provided the clothes for free, that they had paid full price. So there was a lot of sort of the bitchiness of the fashion industry, but also it sort of bummed me out. There was one quote from Stefano Tanci, who's the editor of W, who said, "It makes you realize how powerless we are," which, you know, was a bit of a sad quote. Like, they had tried using all the tools of their disposal to sort of influence this election and, you know, world's tiniest violin for the editor of W. But but still, you know, the imaging and messaging is a huge part of a campaign, and this still didn't make a difference.
Yeah. And that's obviously for an industry where image is everything, where image is the whole thing. It mm-hmm. is an industry about image. I imagine there are many people are feeling that their image is very wounded by their having, you know, Vogue made its first endorsement. It endorsed Hillary Clinton, and
which might have been a problem.
Well, might have, but, you know, again,
I still think Anna Wintour will. I mean, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, no. Ultimately, Anna Wintour is still a very powerful woman, yeah. But she's a little bit bruised, I suspect.
But I think Melania. First of all, Melania has been on the cover of Vogue,
uh-huh. right?
In her
Christian, wedding gown.
Christian Dior, or which, Christian LaCroix wedding
which
gown.
You were like, that's a cop out.
I said,
oh, no, wedding.
Claire, by the way, 538 readers will be excited to know, is a devoted reader of Vogue.
Devoted.
Like, she loves it.
Years long subscriber. Yeah. Love it. Yeah. Well, I kind of felt like her Vogue cover was a little bit of a cop out because, honestly, like Kim Kardashian, she was there sort of because of her marriage. Like, mm-hmm. it felt like this very... So Melania was on the cover of Vogue in her wedding dress. Like, Kim was with Kanye, right? In her
film. Was she in a wedding dress too? Or something?
No, but it was very... I mean, it was very much like... I love June's, what is it, campaign consort. Like, it did kind of feel like it was because mm-hmm. she's the consort.
Yeah.
But it is... I mean, the one thing I will say about the First Lady is that it telegraphs the first family, what their values are, and, you know, how she dresses in an odd way, right? Like, are they down to earth? Are they a little preppy, you know, like, you know, mm-hmm. but preppy and a little bland, whatever. Mm-hmm. For the Trumps, I mean, their whole image is, I'm also a Daily Mail reader, and there was a great, item yesterday that was like, this article runs all the time, but like, here's what the inside of Trump's apartment looks like. And it's, they are aspirational for Americans for work. And people are always like, how can working class people?
But can you describe their apartment though? And I want to preface this by saying I read the same Daily Mail article. And the amazing thing about it is their decorator died in the mid 80s. So you know how contemporary it is. Anyway, go.
It is a mixture of like Louis the 14th and like, I don't know, like, how the czar's palaces must have been. I mean, it's gold-plated everything. And people are always like, how is this man connecting with, you know, working-class people? And it's because it's a very accessible version of what wealth is.
Yeah.
If you are a person who doesn't encounter wealth, you're like, that's what it looks like. Mm-hmm. As opposed to sort of the more, perhaps, you know, someone on the Upper East Side, Ivanka, I follow her on Instagram. Ivanka's apartment is
neutrals,
muted couches, right? Like all her palette is very sophisticated. And that I think is a little bit more like there's more sort of subtle signaling going on. Whereas Trump is just like, I'm rich. And you want to be like this? You want a hot wife and not and still like do your hair and like, I don't know. Uh-huh.
And like his wife, Trump wears foreign made clothes, mm-hmm. interestingly enough.
Brioni suits. And Chinese made ties.
So June, yes. Both Ivanka and Melania are themselves actually in the fashion industry. Right. They both have fashion lines. Mm-hmm. And they both appear to have been using the campaign to move product.
Yeah.
How do you so during at the RNC, there was like $140 or something dress, sheath dress that Ivanka wore that was then available for purchase on her site that sold out. Just this week, she
tweeted out, or her somebody on her team tweeted out
and emailed reporters. Right.
Sorry, somebody on her team sent out a press release to reporters about how readers could get their own copies of the bangle that she wore on 60 Minutes, which was much pricier. It was
like $10,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So not within the not sort of campaign prices.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that seems to me to be a conflict of interest in the making. I mean, yes, we know. Like, he's a businessman. We know that there's going to be all these issues with his business and his family and blind trust and so on. But for the daughter of the president-elect to be essentially shilling for her jewelry line, that's trouble.
It's not a lemonade stand. Like,
yeah. Was it Vanessa Friedman who wrote the piece in the Times mm-hmm. about it? I mean, and they sort of, their spokesperson came back and said, we're still working on transitioning from campaign.
Yeah.
Like, I think they know it's an ethical gray
area. We're working on transitioning America to mafia values. And when you guys catch up, we'll be here.
But I do think the blind trust stuff and whether or not, you know, the fact that the Trump kids are on the transition team, that does get into real things that Americans should really keep an eye on, right? Yeah. Which is that, like, it is not normal. There are ethics rules about nepotism and hiring within the West Wing, although, you know, Bobby Kennedy, Attorney General, right? Like, there's some precedent.
Was qualified, however.
Yeah, but I mean, it's...
There's an exception in America for Kennedy. Didn't you know that?
That was in the Malone family.
Constitutional amendment. Well, I look forward to seeing what Michelle Obama will wear in her post-First Lady days.
Sweats.
All right.
Her arms will still be amazing.
Yeah.
All right, guys, let's move on to recommendations. But before we do that, June, are you selling us $10,000 bangles or do we have a different sponsor this week?
Sorry.
Our third sponsor this week is not Ivanka Trump. It is instead Blue Apron.
All right, June, what's your recommendation this week?
So I think a lot of people have been going to a happy place. Well, a lot of Democrats and Clinton supporters have been going, trying to find a happy place in the wake of last week's vote. And mine went all the way to Australia. This month, we subscribed to Acorn TV, which I've kind of been putting off forever because I figured, well, you know,
same.
You know,
what
it's
the hell
like,
is Acorn TV?
Squirrels, all 24/7 squirrels.
Acorn TV it's a streaming service that features a lot of British and Australian and New Zealand shows, and like some of the bigger shows are already available on Netflix, Hulu, whatever. But I finally gave in when the election drew near, and I have become obsessed with an Australian show called Janet King. And Janet King, the title character, is both a Crown prosecutor, so she gets to wear like a cool wig and be harsh in court, which, you know, I always enjoy. And also, she is a lesbian mother. And it's kind of amazing to have the title character of a major TV show, which is actually really good. It's a really good legal procedural with a lot of swearing, because I guess in Australia they really swear in their TV shows.
Doesn't surprise
does not
me.
Surprise
yeah,
me.
Yeah. Speaks dry, then yeah. That she just is in a lesbian who just had twins. So Janet King, Acorn TV, really recommend it. No squirrels, no acorns.
Cool. Claire, what do you got?
Yeah, this is so. Usually, I listen to your recommendations.
Ooh.
So mine is lighter and in the fashion realm because I think we could all use a little lightness. I recently went to the opera for the first time. Mm. And I...
What did you see?
I saw Don Giovanni.
Oh, Don Giovanni.
But I didn't know what to wear. And so I did that Google search, what should you wear to the opera? And lo and behold, what popped up was the Metropolitan Opera being like, yeah, we know. We don't know what to wear. So they had this guideline that was basically like, whatever you want. But it also leads you to this style blog that the Met has. And it's called lastnightatthemet.com. And it's sort of this wonderful, if anyone was a fan of the Sartorialist blog, it's sort of like that, but with like New York's most eccentric characters. So like I've got it pulled up right now and there's a guy in a top coat and this beautiful embroidered cape. And it's a lot of sort of elderly women wearing these beautiful, like chunky, funky jewelry. It's just like, it's a really fun tour and like great people watching kind of thing. And I would highly recommend just scrolling through because it's sort of addictive.
Did your picture make it on?
It did not.
All right. Well, you got to try again. My recommendation is for an American show about Britain. Jean, what do you think of The Crown?
Love it.
Yeah.
Quietly love it. We talked about it on the Culture Gabfest last week and had a lot of issues. I don't like the royal family, but I kind of love the show.
Yeah, it's like, it's, you know, if you're into escapism right
now. It's not American. It is British.
Oh, it is British?
It is British made. It's just
by Netflix. The Queen, right?
Yeah.
It felt like an American take on Britain.
It was made with an eye to the American audience. There's okay. a lot of queensplaining.
Yes. Anyway, I'm into it. If you want to not think about our government and think about someone else's, at least we don't have a king so far. And then the other thing I wanted to recommend is a lot more earnest. A lot of people, you know, are talking about what you can do in the wake of Donald Trump's election. And a lot of people are saying, you know, give to the ACLU, give to
Planned Parenthood,
and certainly do that if you feel so moved. Consider, you know, places that tend to the needy, Catholic Charities, whatever your personal preference is. But sort of near and dear to my heart. Consider subscribing to a daily newspaper, which is something that I did this year. And, you know, not only are papers like the New York Times and the Washington Post doing important work covering Donald Trump, but just as a consumer experience, I genuinely recommend it. I'm someone who's a little addicted to the internet, and it gets me outside of that. And it makes me read things that I might not necessarily have clicked on online. And it's just really comprehensive and great. And you'd be supporting journalism and, you know, sticking it to Donald Trump, who really hates/is obsessed with the New York Times. And consider your local paper too. Okay. And I promise I'll never be that earnest in my recommendation again.
Right on.
All right. Thank you guys so much for coming on. I did not think I could have fun talking about Donald Trump, but maybe we did. I don't know. No one shunned in there.
I would never contradict you, sister.
It was a rootin' tootin' good time.
Anyway, for June and Claire, I'm Noreen Malone. We'll see you in 2 weeks when Hannah is back. Thanks to our producer, Jason DeLeon. Our managing producer, Steve Lichtai. Andy Bowers is the executive producer of Slate Podcast. And thanks, as always, to our fantastic intern, Daniel Schrader. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Go to our show page, slate.com/XX, our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest. Email us at the XXGabFest@slate.com or subscribe on iTunes. See you in 2 weeks.